You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. We've got another USMNT-centric episode for you this week. We've also got construction workers next door. Hopefully that sound doesn't bleed through too much, but if it does, apologies. We're breaking down three players on this episode who are in the US pool for now. Maybe one of them less so later on. We're also answering three USMNT-centric listener questions. Before we get to that, I should introduce my co-hosts for today. Up first, a man who I'm assuming is already preparing himself for the first leg of the CONCACAF Champions League final. It's Joe Lowry. Joe, how we feeling, my friend?
I'm ready. I'm feeling confident about the Seattle Sounders that are going down to play Pumas in Mexico. Then they've got the return leg in Seattle. Marshawn Lynch had a promo video about that second leg. So
good.
I mean, I'm ready. Marshawn's ready. What more do you need, Seattle?
The tiny dog is ready.
Oh, that's good stuff. And that voice you just heard is good stuff. Rounding out the crew is a lifelong Unai Pumas fan who wanted to spend the entire episode discussing his beloved club. It's Graham Ruthven. Graham, I will give you a cool $5 if you could name me a single player who plays for Pumas. I can only name one because I just looked at their roster. And if you do a convincing job of guessing, as in if you just make up a name, there's a decent chance I will believe that that's a real player.
I think this $5 is going to stay firmly in your pocket. I mean, I have no idea where to start, I'm afraid. CONCACAF Champions League has not made it. The broadcast rights have not made it to the UK yet. It's not really a mainstream product yet. But I do know that Pumas have decent kits, as most Liga MX teams do have. So maybe I am. Maybe I'm supporting Pumas because I like their kits in Seattle this season. I'm not sure about that kit they've got this year. Although it does look better on Marshawn Lynch.
Joe, can you name any Pumas players or one in particular who used to play in MLS?
Yeah, I was going to say they have Sebastian Saucedo on
That's
their team.
The
they have a few other relatively high-profile guys that we don't necessarily need to get into on this particular episode. But I do think, guys, that Seattle has a real chance to win this thing. I think they have a better chance than any of the MLS teams who have ever been in the final. There's the biggest quality discrepancy between the MLS side and the Liga MX side in this final. You know, Toronto had a really, really good team. They lose to Chivas. LAFC had a very good team. That was in the COVID Orlando sort of bubbled CCL. They had a strong team, couldn't get the job done. This team, to me, feels like, even though they're kind of tanking it in MLS and not looking very good in the league, it looks like they have the ability and the talent to get this job done.
Well, we shall see, but I look forward to that game. And maybe it is the Seattle Sounders' time. If so, I hope we get a giant statue of Marshawn Lynch at some point. Until that happens, we should talk about some other Americans in the national team pool. We've got three to be discussed. We've talked through a lot of the big names, the obvious names. We've talked about a few on the periphery. And we're going to continue that today with a couple names that have been either in the U.S. national team previously, but not so much recently, or have yet to make an appearance and might not ever, as is the case with Jonathan Gomez, because, Joe, he is currently in camp with Mexico. Tell us about Mr. Gomez.
Yeah, so Jonathan Gomez is a dual national. He's a Mexican-American. He moved from Louisville City in the USL Championship to Real Sociedad. Now he's playing with their B team, who's coached by Xabi Alonso. So that's a pretty high-profile manager in the picture. As far as the youth national team setup goes, because Gomez is just 18, he's been a part of both the U.S. youth national teams and the Mexican youth national teams. So he's been involved in both of those setups. He got a U.S. men's national team cap in that December Camp Candy Cane friendly against Bosnia and Herzegovina back at the end of 2021. So he came off the bench in that game. So he has made an appearance for the U.S. and experienced that environment in at least some ways. And then Tata Martino called him up to Mexico's friendly, and the camp surrounding that friendly against Guatemala on Wednesday. That's tomorrow as we're recording on Tuesday, April 26th. So my first reaction to that was, makes perfect sense, right? We've seen some of these dual nationals go and experience both sides of this. And even Greg Berhalter has encouraged players to go and experience what it's like to be involved in both of those environments. But my second thought after that was...
As a spy.
That was not it, but it should have been. My second real thought was, won't he be cap tied to Mexico if he goes and plays in that friendly because he's already played for the U.S.? Would he not have to file some sort of switch? And the answer from what I've been able to dig up is no. So I don't know if anyone else out there had a similar question, but apparently because it was a friendly that he played against Bosnia and Herzegovina, that means he wasn't really tied to the U.S. in the first place. And this friendly against Guatemala isn't a competitive game either. So I just wanted to toss that in there because I was thinking about that and trying to figure that out. I don't know if anyone else cared about that at all, but all that to say, you shouldn't care about it because it doesn't seem like that's a concern. But Jonathan Gomez, young, talented, teenage left back, still deciding his international future. But I think it's still interesting to analyze because whatever he picks, Taylor, he's going to be involved in CONCACAF for the next decade. I'd put some pretty decent money on that.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And I think it's really fair of Greg Berhalter to say, experience both and then make a decision. Because I know, speaking as a solely a fan of the U.S. men's national team, you want to believe that these players all aspire to just play for the United States. And obviously that's not the case. But you want to believe that, oh, no, they all would just choose the U.S. That's their first choice. Of course, they're going to be there. And that isn't the case. I think from every dual national or every person who has dual nationality I've ever spoken to, you can identify as both and both can be equally influential in who you are. So I think in a lot of ways it makes a ton of sense for Greg Berhalter to push players to go experience other camps. Because if you don't, if you say no, I need a decision right now, you're really limiting them. You're not exposing them to other opportunities. And ultimately there's always going to be that what if. What might have been? Should I have done that? And I think if a player goes and doesn't have a great time or doesn't feel that vibe and then they come back to the camp and to the U.S. camp, that is, and feel better, feel more incorporated, whatever it might be, I think that was the case with, say, Serginho Dest or Yunus Musah. I really like that approach to let people make their own choices and then once they have, assume that that is the choice that they are most comfortable with and then approach them as a player of the team and if not, a player of a rival team that we will never like again. I think that's roughly how I'm seeing it, although I won't dislike Jonathan Gomez until he goes full Rafa Marquez. But until then, he's an 18-year-old Mexican-American left back, as you said, Joe, formerly of Louisville City, now with Real Sociedad B. Graham, what did you make of young Mr. Gomez, a player I'm assuming you haven't watched a ton of before this?
I think earlier in the year, I can't remember why this was the case. I did watch some game tape. I think it was because he moved to Real Sociedad at the start of this year, right, from Louisville. So I think maybe when that move happened, because I watch a lot of La Liga, I did go and kind of scope him out and look at some of his game tape back then. And there is definitely an exciting player there. He's an attack-minded left-back who, looking at his game tape, he likes to, one of his best qualities is he likes to exchange passes with centrally positioned teammates to get in behind opposition defences. He's a good runner with the ball at his feet. But when I was watching those game tapes, I noticed he's very good at moving the ball quickly and he appreciates how that can open up space for him. And there was one assist for Louisville City last year where he exchanges a quick pass with a teammate. He bursts to the byline. He kept the ball that little bit longer than you might expect, which I think showed some good game intelligence because then he runs along the byline. He beats his man and then squares it for a teammate to finish at the back post. And I think that demonstrated a lot of what Gomez offers and why there is so much excitement around him, you know, physicality, quick passing, and also the ability to produce a final product, which for fullbacks is sometimes something that comes quite later on in their career. That's maybe sometimes the last thing that comes, but he seems to already have that. And in terms of his technique, he strikes the ball very cleanly. His use of the ball is very good. When he plays a pass, it's normally quite nicely weighted. He's very prudent with the ball. You don't see him losing it all that often. He plays through balls behind the defence. He's good with crosses. He plays 1-2s in tight spaces. And he took a lot of set pieces, corner kicks for Louisville as well. I couldn't quite find if he's been taking a lot of them for Real Sociedad B under Xabi Alonso. But all that to say is he has a lot of the fundamentals you would look for in a modern attacking fullback. He's got good strength, good balance, good speed. That physical package that I talk about there allows him to be more proactive on the defensive side of the game than most attack-minded fullbacks. He's got good stamina. He's good at making ball recoveries and closing down opponents. I think his body positioning, if we're looking at some of his flaws, I think his body positioning could be refined. There are times when he gets caught on the wrong side, when his positioning ties him in knots a little bit, and he needs to do a better job of keeping himself slightly more nimble to make tackles and interceptions, or even just to jockey opponents, because sometimes he gets square a little bit too often, or in a 2v2 or a 3v3, he can kind of be given a little bit of the runaround there. But he's still young, and as I say, when you look at the fundamentals of his game, I think he's going to be at the in the professional game, certainly, but a good level of the professional game for a long time to come.
Graham, forgive me if this is a very obvious question, but I'm just curious. When you say his use of the ball is very good, is that like on the ball dribbling? Is that passing? Is that his decision making in transition? Or is it all of the above?
It was more his passing, to be honest, okay, that caught the eye for me, because I think with fullbacks you kind of expect them to carry the ball to a certain extent, and he does that. As I say, that one assist, he certainly carries the ball. He carries the ball all the way up the left side and then right away along the byline. But it was his passing, because sometimes I think fullbacks now, when you have Yao Cancelo and Trent Alexander-Arnold, they are being asked to be more creative forces, and I'm not saying he's anywhere close to that level, but he does feel very comfortable on the ball when I was watching him, and that was reflected in some of his numbers as well, were pretty impressive.
So he's not at the Yao Cancelo level yet, Joe. But if we're talking about him potentially playing for the United States, I'm assuming he's one that if he were to choose to play for the US, we're thinking is a 2026 option, less so a 2022 option.
That's exactly right. And I think that's probably true with all three of the players we're talking about today. Maybe not, and we'll dive into that more in just a little bit. He's raw. And Graham, I agree with pretty much everything you said about Jonathan Gomez. His work on the ball is what caught my eye the most. You certainly see that pop with Louisville City and USL, and you see glimpses of it with Real Sociedad B. The issue is that team is just really bad. Like, they're in the relegation places right now in the second division in Spain. They just don't get on the front foot a whole lot. Jonathan Gomez doesn't get a chance to do his thing a whole lot, which is, to go back to the Alex Mendes thing of a couple weeks ago, maybe not the worst thing, right? I think his decision-making needs a little refinement, and I think his defensive positioning, Graham, to your point, needs a little refinement as well. And I do think he's having chances to do that under Alonso and at Real Sociedad B. So I think he's a good player, but he's raw, right? And we see that on the footage for Real Sociedad B. So I think it does make sense, Taylor, to get back to your initial question, for him to be a post-2022 option. I don't think it's realistic that he finds his way into the pool right now with how young and how raw he is. Is he a worse player than George Bello or than Sam Vines at this point? I doubt it, but I don't think there's enough between those players at the moment to make up the ground that Gomez needs to cover to jump over them to then be behind Jedi Robinson in that left-back depth chart. So I think it's unlikely he makes his way into the picture before this World Cup, but I certainly think there's a window for him in both the U.S. and Mexico to make that decision and be a real part of those teams for the next cycle.
And I also think there's scope for him to make that jump up to the Real Sociedad senior squad relatively quickly, even if he is struggling at the moment. La Real don't have great defensive depth, particularly in the fullback areas. I mean, Nacho Monreal is still getting games for Real Sociedad. So
wow.
when Xabi Alonso does make that step up, it's an open secret in Spain, he's going to be the next Real Sociedad manager, despite the fact that maybe he's struggling slightly in the Segunda division right now. Maybe Jonathan Gomez is one of the players he takes with him up into that senior ranks. And as you say, Joe, behind Anthony Robinson and Sergino Dest as the right back, there's really not much to divide the options that the USMNT have in those fullback positions. I'm going to call it the glob. It's what I'm going to call that group of about eight fullbacks, which is just kind of congealed into one group. And I think Jonathan Gomez could be in that glob and could maybe rise to the top.
And I think the thing that I'm hearing a lot of is positivity, but conditional statements. He could, he might, he should. We'll see what happens. And I think all of that goes to Joe's point that he is more of a 2026 player. And if he decides to play for Mexico after this camp, then obviously that's his choice. But I also am not going to feel the same level of loss that I would have for Sergino Dest or Yunus Musa, because we don't know yet. And I think that's what I kept going back to when watching Jonathan Gomez. Graham, to your point, when he's with Louisville, there is this willingness to go at players, to take people on, and to just kind of roll the dice, I think, because he's a big fish in a relatively small pond. With Sociedad B, I saw less of that. And Joe, I think you're absolutely right to point out that maybe it's their poor form in the table means he is less adventurous. And so I saw him staying back a bit more, at times carrying the ball forward, certainly, but it seemed like he was much more inclined to be a little bit deeper. Of the two fullbacks, he tended to stay back more so than his opposite member, who was maybe usually 20 yards further up the pitch than him. And so I do wonder if maybe there's an element of he's being asked to do that more defensive job because that's what they need right now. And maybe as time goes on, as he's able to move up into the senior team, we will see him develop into an even more modern fullback. But since he's not right there yet, it's not as though the U.S. should be calling him in to make sure he's stuck with the team or he's in there, I think, until we know more about him. So I think I'm okay, regardless of what happens, although I do see a lot of talent there, a lot of potential there. Graham, do you feel like that would be a big miss if he were to declare for the United, or for Mexico over the United States?
It depends what constitutes a big miss, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a miss, you know, because he has got a lot of potential, but it doesn't feel like, as you say, he's not a Dest or a Musa. And the US is pretty well served in his position. I mean, everyone seems to be fairly happy with Jedi Robinson at left back for the World Cup. And as I say, there's options behind him, you know, George Bello and so on, Sam Vines. But yeah, there is still a bit of me that just goes, cap tie him, just give him a cap, and then he's secured. You know, if you need him further down the line, then he's yours if you need him. But I understand why Berhalter. You need to treat these players like people, and particularly when it's something as fundamental to someone's identity as their nationality, you can't really railroad them into a decision. So it's fair to let him experience both camps and come to a decision when he's ready.
The last thing I have on Gomez here, Taylor, is I'm just wondering about the general trends that we're seeing in the U.S. and Mexico dual national conversation, I guess, is the best way I can phrase that. So Efra Alvarez goes and decides that he wants to play for Mexico, and I think that was always expected from him. But he had an opportunity in both arenas. And then you've got Julian Araujo, who goes to play for Mexico after getting, if not multiple caps, at least one cap for the U.S. men's national team. David Ochoa goes to play for Mexico after experiencing the youth setup for the U.S. And certainly playing with the U-23s and being involved with the U.S. senior team during the summer this past year in 2021. Ricardo Pepi chooses the U.S. over Mexico, a player who's eligible to play for both sides. I just wonder in a macro way, and this isn't to point fingers at any particular player or anything like this, I just wonder what the numbers are going to turn out to be, right? I think I've heard people speculate that maybe for every 10 Mexican-American dual nationals that Mexico ends up having play for them, the U.S. might get one. And I'm curious to see what those numbers look like over the next 5 or 10 years. I mean, Jonathan Gonzalez, to go back a few years ago, is another player who decided not to play for the U.S., and I think he could have been an impactful player for the U.S. at that time, maybe less so now. So there's no point here, but I just am curious personally to see how the tides are flowing and which direction they're flowing. Of course, each situation is individual, and it should be, and I'm not saying that there's nearly any groupthink or anything like that here, but I'm just curious to see what happens with Jonathan Gomez, certainly, but also maybe with this entire pool of players and if there's any trends that we've noticed through those players.
If you're a young player at the moment, surely the U.S. is a better environment for you than Mexico with their aging. I can just imagine turning up to the Mexican camp as an 18-year-old and Guillermo Ochoa's doing the towel snap thing at you in the dressing room, in the locker room, and just thinking, oh, I wish I was with the U.S. and Tim Weah and all those guys seem a bit cooler.
Andres Guardado and Ache are talking about like the early 2000s and no one has any idea what they're talking about. Yeah, I see what you're talking about, Graham. All right, yeah, don't go to the old-timers club.
Listening to their mini discs.
Yeah, exactly. What are these compact discs that you want me to listen to? No, thank you. All right, well, I think we've somehow discussed Jonathan Gomez in a number of different ways. Let's take a break, and then let's talk about two more players in the U.S. pool.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify.
You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. We've talked Jonathan Gomez in a number of different ways. Let's talk about two more players in the pool. Graham Ruthven, let's start with Matthew Hoppe, 21-year-old attacker who theoretically plays for Mallorca in La Liga, but doesn't necessarily play for them all that often.
No, he hasn't had much game time since moving to Real Mallorca from Schalke last season. Of course, he burst onto the scene for Schalke last season with a hat-trick not long after his Bundesliga debut. He makes his debut in November last season. I think the hat-trick is in January, and he becomes the first American to score a hat-trick in the Bundesliga. He follows that up with a handful of more goals for a struggling Schalke team. And at that point, there was a lot of excitement around Hoppe. We should mention that he has a forward. And from there, he makes the switch to Real Mallorca, who had just been promoted to La Liga. I think the expectation was he would be an important player for them in La Liga this season. And due to injury at the start of the season, he doesn't really get an opportunity. And then even after injury, he's been a peripheral figure. Real Mallorca have favoured a more orthodox number nine to lead the line. And then on the right wing, which is maybe where Hoppe could fit in, they have Taki Kubo on loan from Real Madrid. So he hasn't had much opportunity to show what he can do. And it already feels like he has to move on from Mallorca. Keep in mind, it was a permanent move to Mallorca, not a loan move from Schalke. So he is tied to that club. So even if it is a loan move, I think he needs to get out and get some game time. He's been linked with Atlanta United recently. Maybe he plays as a number nine for them. Maybe he's a good fit. But he's a player that I find very interesting, I have to say. I think when you're assessing him and the sort of player he is, the first thing you have to mention is his natural pace and the advantage that gives him as a forward. He's commonly an option for teammates to find in behind a high defensive line, and he's generally quite good at timing his runs to get on the end of passes. And if you can get Hoppe into a foot race, there is a good chance that he's going to win it and find himself in a dangerous position. And if you look at the goals he scored for Schalke last season, he scored 6 in the Bundesliga last season, and all of those goals were in the second half of last season as well. So he was in decent form. They are from those sort of opportunities where he gets released in behind. And one thing I've noticed about him is when things are going well, he's very good. You look at some of the finishes for Schalke last season, and they're not always, what I'm trying to say, there's a bit of variety to his finishing. You know, sometimes he'll round the goalkeeper, sometimes they're from a tight angle, sometimes he takes them early. So he's a streaky player, he's a confidence player. When things are going well, they're going very well. Recently, things have been going badly, and when I was watching some of his game tape, some of his decision-making has been pretty poor. He has been played out of the wing, on the wing at times for Mallorca this season, which I don't think he's quite as effective there as when he was playing as a number nine for Schalke. But he's still young, and I think there's still a lot to be excited about with Matthew Hoppe. I think his next move is going to be very important. He needs to play at a club that's going to play to his strengths, and I don't get the sense Mallorca is that team right now.
And Graham, to really like further exemplify what you're talking about, With the software we use, we can pull individual clips or watch individual clips of players based on whatever search parameters. And I usually will do a custom search for players looking for, if you're Matthew Hoppe, an attacker, I'm looking for goals scored, assists, key passes, smart passes, 1v1 take-ons, ball recoveries. When I put all that in and looked for the last five games, there were zero results.
Yikes.
Because he's not doing a ton of those things. So when you go then and watch what he is doing, I think you hit the nail on the head, Graham, that he does strike me as a streaky confidence player. And when he doesn't have that, he's not doing nearly as much. The one that stood out for me, there's a moment in the 69th minute versus Rayo Vallecano. He does apply some pressure. He forces a risky pass from Vallecano that's a turnover, and because of where the ball is turned over, it's won by a Mallorca center back. It's played forward, and now there's a 2v2 situation with Matthew Hoppe. The ball's played into him, and he tries to do a sort of one-time lateral pass to Franco Russo on the left, on his left, and then kind of spin in behind and make the run. But that one-time pass is played behind Russo. Vallecano are able to catch up and then set up their defensive lines, and the move breaks down. And that is the type of sequence that I think, if he's in form, if he's scored a couple goals, if he's feeling it, I think he plays that pass. It's a quick combination, and away they go. And so I end up thinking that this move made sense to me at the time. It's a promoted team. They're going to need exciting attackers, and he's going to get an opportunity to shine. And I think maybe it was wrong place, wrong time, or wrong situation with the injury, but overall it doesn't feel like one that is going to significantly turn around. He's only played 72 minutes so far in 2022, all of those coming in substitute appearances, three of them, I think, throughout this year. So, Joe, where are you on Matthew Hoppe as we discuss him with everything that we've already said?
I'm down on Matthew Hoppe's current situation. I am, quote, the jury's still out, unquote, on Matthew Hoppe's general situation. I think he's a really talented player. I love, Graham, how you highlighted he loves to run in behind. And that's a huge part of his game. Clearly, it's something that's been asked of him by the coaching staff. It's happening so much. But it's also something he's good at, right? He does have speed. He knows when to run. I think some of his runs turn in to these sort of aimless, purposeless forward runs, but I'm not sure if that's his fault or if that's just Mallorca's fault because they're not a good team. I don't know exactly what the issue is there, but Matthew Hoppe, I think, has a ton of talent, and we saw that with the U.S. at the Gold Cup this past summer. He wasn't perfect, and he was doing way too much out there at times playing on the wing, but he can do that stuff. He can be very dangerous in wide areas. He can also be an option as a part of a dual striker pairing or as a single striker if you can fit the rest of the pieces around him and use him in a more realistic way. My concern with Matthew Hoppe right now is this situation feels a whole lot like Josh Sargent at Norwich, doesn't it? Like, obviously Josh Sargent is playing, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find moments this season for Mallorca that have really helped Matthew Hoppe build up the most valuable skill that any player can have, and that's goal scoring. And he should be scoring some goals as a forward, right? As a number nine or whatever you want to call his position, because it's not set right now. I do think he needs to be getting more reps at those things. Yes, it's valuable to learn how to defend and learn how to play in a 4-4-2 and when to press and how to press. That stuff is good, and I'm sure he is learning some of those things despite how difficult the season has been. But he's not getting meaningful attacking reps. He's making his runs in behind, and he's not getting on the ball. He's not having a chance to make any purposeful runs in the box. He might run outside the box, but he's really not getting into those spaces. So between this time at Mallorca and his time with Schalke at the senior team, let's not forget, they were horrible, right? I mean, Matthew Hoppe was playing because they were desperate, right? He was wearing number 40-something because he came from the reserve team and up through that academy. He wasn't really a part of that team, but he came on and he scored some good goals and really made a name for himself and then translated that into a U.S. men's national team appearance. He hasn't really had a chance to play in a stable club environment. He's only ever played just about 1,800 minutes in his pro career so far. It feels like he's been around for a lot longer than that, but that's not even a full season. That's like half a season of professional minutes if you're an every game starter, which clearly he is not. I don't know what's next for Matthew Hoppe. I don't know exactly what should be next for Matthew Hoppe. Maybe that's Atlanta. Maybe it's not. There would certainly be a bit more stability there, but I'm not sure that's even like the most stable place to be right now. I don't know what's next for him. Maybe it's another season in Mallorca, but this has not been, and I'm sure Matthew Hoppe would tell you the same thing, a terribly productive or what seems like a good experience for him over the last 8 months since the summer.
If you look at his game time this season, there's just no way that he's been able to build any consistency.
No,
and that's why when I was looking at his game tape, I kept going back to Schalke because that was where he was getting that consistency and getting that game time. I'm just looking through his minutes right now for Real Mallorca this season. So he gets 30 minutes in September, another 60 minutes in September, where he actually gets an assist away to Real Madrid. His next game is on the 8th of January, where he gets 16 minutes. He then gets 7 minutes on the 15th of January. Then a month later, he gets 33 minutes on the 2nd of February. Then another full month later, he gets 23 minutes in March, and he hasn't featured since then. How on earth is he able to build up any consistency? So that's, I do have some sympathy for him. Obviously, he's not doing it on the training pitch, and Real Mallorca don't feel he has much to offer. But that's why I say he just needs to get out of that situation as quickly as possible. Because when he moved from Schalke, I think we all thought, okay, Matthew Hoppe's going to get some regular game time here. And it's been the complete opposite scenario where he's just not getting a look at all.
And that's where I'm assuming, Joe, when we talked about players that, like, we're talking about 2026 versus 2022, I think you initially said all three, and then you were like, well, maybe one. And I'm assuming that one is Matthew Hoppe. We'll find out with our final player. But if it were Matthew Hoppe, I think the situation is that he does need to move. Even if Mallorca go down, we don't know kind of what his status is going to be or how much he's going to fit in. And I think if you're looking at a player who could potentially be in that squad because of the lack of number nine options or the clear attacking options, or if there's some injuries, you never know. I would like him to move to a club where basically we know he's going to play and we know they're not going to be in a relegation fight. If he goes to a team in the Premier League who are in a relegation scrap, a la Norwich, I don't know if that's going to be the best idea for him. I don't know if he needs to go to a team in even like the Bundesliga or something like that, or maybe even the Eredivisie. I don't know if he needs to go to PSV or Ajax, because I doubt he's playing for either one of those teams.
Yeah.
So it's more to me a club like maybe Vitesse or even like AZ, who are in the European places right now. They're not going to be in the relegation battle, but maybe that's a place where he is good enough to find some minutes to start as a substitute, but then occasionally get some subs and kind of prove himself. Graham, my question for you, if you were to go to a Scottish club, what do you think is the appropriate level for him? Like, I had Celtic on my list, but I'm not sure he's at that level at this point.
I don't think he gets many minutes for Celtic or Rangers, to be honest. I think for Hibs, they need a replacement for Martin Boyle, and Chris Mueller just hasn't done the job for Hibs since he's joined, so maybe Matthew Hoppe comes in and does that job. Hibs would actually be a decent shout, and Roy Keane's going to be their next manager, so if we need to toughen up Matthew Hoppe, then Hibs is maybe the place to send them. When you were talking there, if we could somehow get Matthew Hoppe to Sassuolo in Italy, who play like the most lightning quick transition game in all of European football, and he's not going to be a first team starter for Sassuolo, but if he's coming off the bench for the final 30 minutes, then I think with Berardi, that could be a decent fit. But even then, I think Sassuolo are maybe a slightly higher level than Hoppe is playing at right now. So I would say in Scotland, Hibs are my suggestion.
And didn't Hoppe have like a bit of a clash with Berhalter? Maybe it was during the Gold Cup where he was like doing too much, and maybe they got into it when he was subbed off. I feel like a shirt was made about this.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So now I'm thinking, like, maybe that is what he needs. Maybe he goes to Hibs under Roy Keane and he learns to channel that intensity, that pure hatred, into usable soccer abilities. So yeah, okay, let's get him to Hibs. Let's have him under the tutelage of Roy Keane. He embraces the physicality, and then he goes to Sassuolo and becomes their starting striker and blends those things into a World Cup winning caliber player. I think we all good with that. Hibs under Roy Keane, then Sassuolo, then wins World Cup.
Correct. But when he leaves Hibs under Roy Keane, he'll have lots of tattoos and a big scary dog.
Okay,
is my prediction.
Perfect. Joe, it occurred to me as I was talking about Hoppe being a player potentially in the 2022 squad, you may have very well meant our final player that we're going to be discussing. Is that where you were? Was it Eric Williamson?
Yeah, I don't think Matthew Hoppe's sniffing that World Cup squad. He's in a really tough situation. I agree with Graham. I don't think he's going to make a move to a club nearly as high profile as Celtic or Rangers or PSV or Ajax, or maybe even teams in the Europa League places in the Netherlands. I think he's in a tough spot right now. It's going to take a club that's willing to make and take a gamble and be willing to accept a risk to take on Matthew Hoppe right now if he does leave Majorca. It's a tough situation. But yes, I was talking about Eric Williamson, Taylor Rockwell.
Yeah. Is back, recovered from his long-term injury layoff, is now starting to get minutes. And I had a hard time knowing quite how back to full fitness he is, because you go back and watch him with Portland when he is fully the man in that midfield, and he looks slightly different than he does at present. I'm assuming that will change. But Joe, tell us about Eric Williamson.
Yeah, he's not back to full fitness yet. He tore his ACL last August. That was just after the Gold Cup final that he started against Mexico in that stretch. So he looked like at that point that his stock was rising a bit in the USMNT pool. And then, of course, you have the injury and he's out until just a few weeks ago. He's now getting closer to 90 minutes fit with Portland, but he's not there yet. Three sub appearances and one start in MLS this season. That start came against RSL on Saturday in a 0-0 draw, and he didn't go the full 90 in that game. So we're seeing Eric Williamson slowly progress and get back to full fitness and get back to form. And we're already seeing some of the things that he is really, really good at. He is a phenomenal dribbler and ball progressor when the ball is on the ground. Like maybe the best central midfielder dribbler in all of Major League Soccer. He's similar to give a current and real USMNT mainstay similarity. He's a lot like Yunus Musah in that way. He's not the same build, and they do it a little differently, but if I'm trying to give a quick comparison, Yunus Musah is the guy. They're both ball progressors when it's on the ground, and they both don't really love to pass the ball all that much. Yunus Musah would rather take the ball from point A to point B with the ball at his foot, or at least it seems to me. And Eric Williamson's probably the same way. His passing is okay, and he can certainly ping the ball around when he's not under pressure. Every pro player can do that. But under pressure, he's kind of just fine with the ball at his feet. He's not the best distributor in those kinds of situations, and he's not crazy fast. He doesn't get a ton of pressure to the ball, and this is something that I've talked about with Georgi Mihailovic. Is something I talked about, or at least thought about and talked about with other folks. Maybe it's on this show or not, I can't remember. But with Keaton Parks as well, who is a phenomenal player and similar to Eric Williamson in a lot of ways, they're really technical and skilled on the ball, but they're not really great pressers in central midfield. And so my question with Eric Williamson, and why I don't know if he'll make it to the World Cup, and I certainly think he's on the outside looking in, but even if he hadn't had that ACL tear back in August, I don't know if he makes Berhalter's roster, because he doesn't move like Berhalter's central midfielders move. He doesn't run. He doesn't do that same aggressive pressing that we've seen Berhalter so consciously shift towards with the national team. He doesn't have the same athletic profile as Weston McKennie or Yunus Musah, even as Luca De La Torre, who is certainly not the same build as those other eights. But man, he buzzes around the field and he covers a ton of ground. He does that at club level, and we certainly see him do that with the national team as well. So I love watching Eric Williamson. I think he's a great player, and I think he makes the Portland Timbers a much better team when he's fit and when he's on the field. And I think there maybe should be room for a player like him, or like Keaton Parks, or like Georgi in a deeper midfield spot somewhere in the national team. But I'm not really sure if that's going to happen or not. So that's my Eric Williamson scouting report and kind of his prognosis with the national team. Really skillful player, but I don't know what his next 8 months looks like before and after the World Cup.
Joe, talking about before his injury, how much physicality do you see in his game? Because watching him, especially in that Gold Cup, which I did forget that he started, so to watch him start that Gold Cup final and see him really go in on some tackles, he gets whistled pretty early, and I would say somewhat often, but he's going in hard, he's winning the ball, and if he's not winning the ball, he's making sure to at least get a little bit of the man to stop the play or to just disrupt what's happening. And that stood out to me as a thing where he is, as you said, good enough on the ball. I agree with you. I think when under pressure, he makes either interesting decisions or wrong decisions when it comes to carrying the ball forward or trying to find those passes. When he has the time, less so. But the physical side of his game, what do you make of that, again, pre-injury?
I don't think of it all that highly, to be totally honest, okay. Taylor. I think he was aggressive in that Gold Cup final, and that's a good point by you. But he also, in that Gold Cup final and in the Gold Cup in general, was overrunning players, right? He would go out to press them, and you could see the technique just wasn't there. Maybe he was overamped for that occasion. I don't know what it was. But I think with Eric Williamson, you don't see a lot of those really well-drilled pressing instincts, partially because Portland just don't do that stuff. And I know he's 24, and he's had a few other stops in his career already. Spent a little bit of time in Europe, and he played some in Maryland in college. He's done a few different things now, but he doesn't get those reps regularly. I think that hurts him at a club level. He doesn't get to do that kind of stuff. And he's just not the most athletic guy. He's not all that fast. His top speed is like, I think, bottom third in MLS percentile-wise. So I don't think he brings a ton of upside defensively. He can certainly come in and win the ball if you're right next to him and he can body through you that way. But in terms of running and closing down the ball, I don't think that's one of his strengths.
And final question for you, Joe, about Eric Williamson. Just to pour salt into my own wound, I'm assuming he is a midfielder that would make DC United better. Is that fair to say?
I think so. DC United have a lot of room for improvement. Taxi Fontas just came in and did some good stuff for them as a more creative, more advanced attacking player. But Eric Williamson's so good that I think he makes pretty much every team in MLS better. He has a very specific skill set, and he's really good at those things. And he's good at things that just a lot of other central midfielders in MLS aren't good at. So, yeah, I think if DC United won him back and they did have either his rights or I don't know what MLS mechanism it was at this point, but I think certainly they would with having Eric Williamson back. Yeah, you're right, Greg.
He was in their academy.
There you go.
He was in the DC United academy, and then they lost him, chose to trade him to Portland. He goes to Santa Clara in Portugal for some time, and then he's with Portland, and now he is with Portland, and DC United are where they are. Graham, Eric Williamson is a player I'm guessing you were not quite as familiar with before you got involved with the Total Soccer Show. How familiar are you with him now, and what do you make of him?
So Eric Williamson is a player, before he got injured, I remember watching quite a bit in MLS. From a USMNT perspective, I can't say that I think I watched the Gold Cup final last year. I didn't catch a lot of the Gold Cup last year. Again, not on British TVs all that often, the Gold Cup.
This feels personal at this point. Yeah. Right? It just feels personal.
Yeah, I mean, someone needs to pick up those rights purely for me. I'm willing to pay the... I was going to say I'm willing to pay the thousands of pounds a month, but I'm actually not at all. No, I'm not.
Yep.
I'll just continue with my dodgy stream watching these games. But Eric Williamson, I pretty much echo a lot of what Joe said. I had dribbling down as one of his best qualities. His interception numbers are pretty decent. I think he's pretty proactive at recognising danger. He's in the 99th percentile for interceptions per 90 minutes over the last year, 78th percentile for combined tackles and interceptions. I also had Joe recognised this by saying his under pressure, he's fine. For me, watching him on the game tape and some of his numbers as well, I actually have him slightly worse than fine. He's in the fifth percentile for passes under pressure, which isn't really great at all. I don't think he's terribly press resistant from what I saw in the game tape, and the numbers back that up. But I think he's pretty useful in a quick transition game where there's space on both sides of the ball for him to break up opposition moves and then start them going forward, whether that's with a dribble, or I know he's not a pass master per se, but he does have pretty decent numbers for passes into the penalty area. He's in the 72nd percentile for that, so he does offer something in that regard as well. And I think in congested games where the majority of the play is in the centre of the pitch, though, and there's two or three players around him, he can sometimes be crowded out and lack a little bit of composure, and maybe even some technical ability at times he can be lacking in that regard. But I am nitpicking slightly here because I think he's a very good player, certainly for that Portland Timbers team, and he deserves to be on the radar for the USMNT.
And Joe, if he is on the radar for the USMNT, what needs to happen for him to move further up the depth chart, do you think?
I think his passing needs to improve a little bit, but really I think proving that he can close down the ball and be more aggressive is the thing, if there is anything, and I kind of doubt that there is, going back to what I said earlier, if there is something that can get him into that Qatar roster, it's him being really aggressive and energetic and athletic in that midfield, and that just might not be in his bag, Taylor Rockwell.
Well, there we are. All right, so that's three players scouted, more or less. We'll see how they continue to develop, and if they do, we will talk about them again. But right now, we will take a break and be back to answer three USMNT-centric listener questions. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort.
From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Welcome back to the final segment of today's episode. Folks, we've got three questions. The first comes from Guy Yedweb. Joe, I'm coming to you for this one. Are there any American players who we were hyped about since the Klinsmann era who dropped off the radar, but whom you think could still make an impact before their careers are done? That would be your Heinemans, your Andrew Carltons, nope, or your Gedeon Zelalems.
Yeah, I mean, Gedeon Zelalem is one really for me that I was extremely confident in, or at least let me back up, at least really enjoyed watching. And that extends even to when he moved back and was playing in USL, and then it's still on NYCFC's roster. I wrote even a bit for The Athletic about how he should be something that people were watching for in MLS that year, and that didn't age all that well and still hasn't. So Zelalem is someone who I think could still maybe make an impact in the right situation, but that one kind of seems like the ship has sailed a little bit.
Rangers
there.
Ruined them.
Yeah, yeah. Blame Scotland. I think that's what Ryan does with everything. So I'm going to do it here too. Emerson Heinemann. And I do have my own suggestions, but I want to credit Guy because I think these are really good ones.
Rangers ruined him too.
Emerson Heinemann is one who I think can fight through the Rangers curse. He's actually a guy who I think can still make an impact at club level, at the very least. He's just recently back from an ACL tear, made a couple of sub appearances this year with Atlanta. A very well-rounded central midfielder, a number eight who can do a whole bunch of different stuff. I don't know if he has a national team ceiling at this point, but I think he can be an extremely productive MLS player and could maybe, if he wants to, go back to Europe at some point in his career. So, Guy, I think that's a great shout from you. Two of mine, and these aren't Klinsmann era players, they're after that, but I think we have that whole timeline to work with. Ulianis. Taylor, 21 years old, still very, very young, playing for St. Pölten in Austria's second tier at this point, was without a club for a while, played in the Galaxy Youth Academy and moved to Wolfsburg and played a little bit in their system, and then has kind of been in no man's land for a while. He has three caps, the most recent of which was in November of 2020. He's just so good on his right foot. He's so skilled, and I see that skill, and I just want to see it more and more at a higher level. Maybe he's getting good reps in Austria right now. I don't know. But Ulianis is one, and Jonathan Amon is another. I loved watching Jonathan Amon play for Nordjylland in Denmark. Just 22 years old still. He was capped by Dave Sarakin in 2018 and then by Berhalter in 2019, but has dealt with a bunch of injuries and really hasn't played much at all since 2019. I don't know exactly what the deal is with his club situation right now. Same with Ulianis in terms of what they're doing and where they might be able to go after this year. But I'm extremely high on both of those players, certainly less now than I was back when they were first breaking through in the national team picture. But I think Heinemann, Yanez, and Amon all have something left to give, certainly at the club level and maybe at the national team level.
Yeah, I think those are great shouts, Joe. And I would put Conrad De La Fuente sort of in the Ulianis category of a player that we've heard about since he was very young with the Barcelona Academy. Makes the move to Marseille. Seemed like it was going well, playing as a left wing back or a wing back on various sides. But then Sampaoli comes out and says he's not a professional or he's not interested in being a professional. That's not what you want to hear. I still think Conrad De La Fuente is a player who could be really important for the United States down the line, but maybe needs to sort things out in the present. to Guy's question, when we're talking about Klinsmann-era players, a lot of them have retired or are in more veteran status, where I don't know if they're going to be brought in at this point. The only two that I could see who were in the Klinsmann era, who were used by Klinsmann, who might still come back, would be Bill Hamid, a bit of a reach, and then Ethan Horvath, who had the one cap under Klinsmann. But I think with the goalkeeper position being as like strong as it seems to be at times, but then also vulnerable at times with Turner's injuries, with Stefan occasionally just giving the ball away for funsies, I think there could still be opportunities for different goalkeepers to come in and stake a claim or attempt to stake a claim. And I think Ethan Horvath is in that pool of potential players if something goes wrong or if Berhalter wants to experiment. Bill Hamid, less so. I just have a soft spot for Bill Hamid in my heart. So those are two names that came to mind for me. Graham, did you have anything for this one?
So while I made a joke about Heinemann, he was actually my genuine suggestion, because when I watched him at Rangers, there was so much about him that I liked. He kind of took Rangers by storm a little bit in the second half of the season. He was on loan here, and I think if you look at his minutes and games he's had over the course of his career, he's only ever played 20 league games in a single campaign once, and that was in 2020 for Atlanta. So he's only 26, and if he could somehow in a single campaign get a full campaign of matches in there, that I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest he could push himself back into the fray. And then my slight outsider, I was looking through the Klinsmann era and players that he gave caps to, and as you say, Taylor, it's kind of slim pickings because the Klinsmann era was a while ago now. But I guess as an outsider, maybe Julian Green might be one you would say. He's only 26 and he scores in the 2014 World Cup, right? He comes.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, that was against in the Belgium game, is it? Yeah. And he's playing first team football in the Bundesliga for Greuther Fürth. At the moment, they are bottom of the league, so maybe they're not going to stay there for much longer. But as I say, 26 years old, maybe it's a little bit foolish to completely write him off as a possible USMNT player in the future. I think it's unlikely at this point, certainly in the near future, he's going to be back. But he plays in a position behind the central striker where the US aren't exactly overflowing with options. And yes, that position doesn't really exist in Berhalter's system right now. But in the future, maybe it will. And stranger things have happened for a 26-year-old to age gracefully and find form later in their career, because he does come through fairly early. And there was a lot of hype around him at Bayern Munich. He plays in the Champions League for Bayern Munich, 25 goals in 51 games for Bayern Munich's B team. So there certainly was talent there. And obviously his career has gone slightly awry, but he is still playing in the Bundesliga right now.
I really like that nomination, Graham, because I thought about him and was just like, he's not going to be caught in by Berhalter. He seems like he doesn't quite fit with the plan. So I'm not going to throw him in there. But first of all, you're right, he's only 26. There's always that possibility. But also, for reasons you mentioned about how he breaks into the U.S. and the conspiracy theories, which I do believe that Klinsmann promised him a spot in the World Cup roster if he chose to play for the United States, maybe at Landon Donovan's expense. And so I sort of like the structure of that. If he comes in as a youngster, he does score the goal, but there's some controversy around him. He doesn't hit the highs that maybe we had hoped he would. But then for him to get another chance maybe a couple years from now and become an elder statesman for a team, that's a nice symmetry to his national team career. So I think I like that for the narrative purposes, maybe less so the footballing purposes, because as you said, I'm not quite sure how he fits. But
yeah, and as we all know, narrative is more important than anything else. So that's how I'd pick my squad.
With that in mind, Graham, since we're talking about the Rangers curse, is there a Hibs curse before we send Matthew Hawkey there? Or will he be okay?
There's 100% a Hibs curse.
Is there, Graham, which Scottish club is the least cursed if you had to pick one? Because I feel like that's a difficult question. If I asked you who's the most cursed, I think we're going to get a lot of nominations.
The least cursed, I mean, you've got to go with, well, you would have said Celtic or Rangers until recently, then Rangers suffered complete meltdown 10 years ago, so Celtic, I guess, is the least cursed at the moment.
That probably makes sense. The team that wins the title all the time is probably not that cursed. Next question, which does not involve curses, comes from Tony Carestia. What happened to Tyler Boyd? A great question. Tyler Boyd, now 27, is a New Zealand American attacker, usually a winger, born in New Zealand to a New Zealand father, American mother, raised in the United States until he was 10, then went back to New Zealand. He had, I think, five or so caps for the New Zealand national team, then chose to represent the United States. He could still switch because I believe all those appearances were friendlies and he was eligible to play for the U.S. before he was 18. He gets 10 appearances for the United States. He gets two goals, which I had completely forgotten. But I had also sort of completely forgotten about Tyler Boyd because he really does fade from memory pretty quickly. The question being, why was that the case? And I think, Joe, there's two reasons for this one, and they basically boil down to probably not that good or not good enough to be in the U.S. national team when he comes through. And then as the U.S. evolves, I think it's shown that the winger options there, there's plenty of depth. So he would be pretty far behind a lot of the nominations. But then also, I think for him at club level, he moves to Besiktas and that move does not work out. He doesn't get many opportunities. I think 25 total appearances for Besiktas over 3.5 seasons, something like that. And he's still technically a Besiktas player. He's on loan right now for Chaika Rizespor. But I think club uncertainty plus maybe just not good enough to be one of the U.S. wingers, at least at present, is what happened to Tyler Boyd. That is my abbreviated answer. Joe, I turn to you to fill in some of those holes.
You nailed it, Taylor. I'll do the national team background here. So he was capped a handful of times for the U.S. and was a part of the U.S.'s Gold Cup roster back in 2019. That's the Gold Cup where they lose to Mexico in the final. Mexico kind of drive down the field and score that goal 1-0. They win that thing. The wingers on that Gold Cup roster were Christian Pulisic, who also played some centrally for the U.S. around that time. Christian Pulisic, Paul Areola, Jonathan Lewis, Jordan Morris, and Tyler Boyd. Now, nothing against any of those players, because at least one, if not two or three of them, will likely be on the U.S.'s World Cup roster later this year. But those players are not Gio Reyna, Brendan Aaronson, and Tim Weah, right? Along with Christian Pulisic. My point there is the U.S.'s winger depth and quality at the top end of the pool is so much higher now than even it was 3 years ago, right? Not even 3 years ago, thinking back to the summer of 2019. Soon after that Gold Cup, Gio Reyna came into the first team picture. Brendan Aaronson came into the first team picture. Tim Weah had already been in that picture briefly. He'd gotten his cap under Greg Berhalter in 2020. And then had caps earlier on under Dave Sirikan and before that in that whole pre-Berhalter era. So all of a sudden, now you're infusing Tim Weah and Gio Reyna and Brendan Aaronson along with Christian Pulisic, and you still have Paul Areola and Jordan Morris, who I think are probably better players than Tyler Boyd. And suddenly on the national team side of things, he's not really in the picture. Then you add in Conrad De La Fuente into that group, and there's other young exciting players that were pushing for caps and pushing for call-ups with what they were doing at club level. And Taylor, this is where I want to turn it back to you. Tyler Boyd's club situation was a lot more tumultuous than any of these other really top-end wingers that I've already mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. He moves to Besiktas in July of 2019. They had sacked their manager, Şenol Güneş, at the end of the 2019 season. So new manager, Abdullah Avcı, comes in. We don't know if Tyler Boyd was a player that he had targeted or if Tyler Boyd had just sort of had a good enough season in the Turkish Super League that he was on Besiktas's radar. But he moves to Besiktas and then Avcı is sort of utilizes him, but then is sacked in January of 2020, only 6 months after appointment. So not a ton of time to develop that relationship. Sergen Yalçın is brought in to see out the season. He lasts until December of 2021. Then there's an interim manager. Now Valerian Ismail, formerly of West Brom, is their current manager. And I think that all of that uncertainty, when you're a new manager coming into a club like Besiktas, who we should note are a very big club, at least in Turkey, there's going to be a pressure to figure things out and hit the ground running. And I think an international player who isn't at that like high standard or doesn't have that name recognition isn't going to sell a bunch of tickets, isn't going to get a ton of headlines, I think becomes surplus to requirement, such that he literally is left out of the squad because there are foreign player limits. I think he is a player that exceeds those. He's not in the 14, I think, is the number. And so that's when he starts getting loaned out, and now he's with Chaika Rizespor, who are not a particularly large or esteemed club in Turkey. So I think we see him sort of going back to the level he was at. I think it was Ankara Gücü is where he was, not Ankaraspor, before moving to Beşiktaş, and that feels maybe like the appropriate level. And so ultimately, I think it's that Tyler Boyd found his level. It's just maybe not what we hoped it would be, because he was one of those dual nationals who could play for the U.S., and now he's going to play for the U.S. Oh, and oh, he's playing in Turkey, and that's really exciting. And I think we kept, or I at least kept expecting there to be that moment when he would skin two or three defenders and then put in a perfect pass for a goal, and like, oh, that's what we've been waiting for. And instead, he would have little moments, but then other moments where there was a heavy touch or he dribbled out of bounds, and it felt like, oh, right, maybe there's a reason why New Zealand weren't so depressed to lose him. So that is about where things stand. You never know what will happen. He's still 27, so he could still really catch fire with Rizespor and end up making the World Cup squad, but that seems fairly unlikely. Anything else to be discussed when it comes to Tyler Boyd, gentlemen, or should we move on to our final question?
Great hair. Really good hair, from what I remember.
Well said, Joe. Joe, good stuff. I'm going to come back to you for this one. From Clay W., if the U.S. men's national team played all of its players' clubs, which clubs would likely win in a single match? You can assume the following, says Clay. Neutral venue, both squads are 100% healthy, and the U.S. men's national team players can play on both sides. We're going to clone them for purposes of this experiment.
Okay, that's good to know, because that was my first question when reading through this. Before I got to the end, what happens? Does Tyler Adams only play for one side? How does that change things? But no, this is pretty straightforward. If it's a single match, it's a total crapshoot with a lot of clubs, because soccer is kind of random in that way. That's why international tournaments with one-off knockout competitions are so insane and are not always the best indicator of a team's relative quality. So I'm going to set that aside, though, because this is a fun thought exercise. I'm going to just assume in my head that it's a best of three series. That just comforts me in some way, and you guys are just going to have to live with that. I have six teams that I think, six club teams that would beat the U.S. for sure, that are associated with U.S. men's national team players. Graham, I want you to check me as I go through this list. I'm going to list off my six, and then I want to know if you have any different ones that you think are definitely in that list, and then I have some others that I think maybe could on a good day. Manchester City with Zach Steffen, that's an obvious one. FC Barcelona with Sergino Dest. RB Leipzig with Tyler Adams. Juventus with Weston McKennie. Borussia Dortmund with Gio Reyna. And Chelsea with Christian Pulisic. Graham, checks out, doesn't check out, what you got?
So those are the six that I had that would definitely beat the USMNT.
Okay.
I also had some competitive teams as well that would give them a good game. So I had Valencia with Musa, I had Lille with Tim Weah, and I had Red Bull Salzburg with Brendan Aaronson. I think they would be competitive matches with the US.
I totally agree. Salzburg was the one I had next, sort of in a tier all on its own. That team made a real dent in the Champions League after that first leg against Bayern, where they were probably not the better team in that game, but they make it out of the group and they do end up facing off against Bayern, which is pretty huge for them. They clearly have talent there. That's Brendan Aaronson's team. Valencia with Musa is one I certainly had, Graham. And then I had a few of those Bundesliga mid-table teams, Hoffenheim with Chris Richards, Wolfsburg with John Brooks, if we can still count him, and Gladbach with Joe Scally. I think those teams would lose to the U.S. along with Valencia in maybe a best of three series, but I'm not 100% confident in the U.S. I think those teams would give the U.S. men's national team a game. Taylor, where do you stand on this? Do you agree with what we've got so far? Do you have others that you think could maybe take down the U.S.?
I think I agree with everything you all have said. I'm a little bit more like back and forth on some other teams, mostly because I think ultimately, like, one condition there would have to be to really round this out from Clay would be that it's not just that everyone's healthy. It's that, like, both teams have had the exact same amount of time to prepare from scratch almost. Because, like, looking at Salzburg for a moment, that is a team that drills and drills and drills to play a certain way, but they have the time, because they're a club, to do that so that they can have different looks and have different permutations, but everybody has a really good understanding of what's being asked of them. Contrast that with the U.S. under Berhalter, where there's been talk about how his system is too complicated or players don't know what's being asked of them in any given moment on occasion. And I wonder if a team that's just playing a very unified style of soccer, a very identified, codified style of soccer, if that would end up causing the U.S. problems. And I think it would. So I think there's smaller teams like, say, a Salzburg, who could cause the U.S. problems just because they've got that sort of background and that unified approach. I'm not sure who else would be on that list. And then you could find maybe, like, cheat answers, because like there's Chituro Odunze, the 19-year-old goalkeeper who has never played for the United States, is eligible to do so, but he is on the books at Leicester. Like, I think Leicester would beat the U.S., but it's not also one that maybe jumps to mind right away the way, say, Dortmund or Chelsea do.
Sure. Yeah, I think, man, Leicester would give the U.S. a game. I think the U.S. could take that. Taylor, your really? Point about prep time is a really good one, because I think if RB Salzburg has time to do their thing and really lead up to this game, they probably are going to beat the U.S. Some of these other teams, I think the U.S. could do damage against, even with the same cadence, even with the club teams keeping their cadence and the national teams keeping theirs. It wouldn't be easy, but I think the U.S. could take down those mid-table Bundesliga teams. I think they might be able to take down Valencia and Lille. It starts to get a little easier after that, right, with Arminia Bielefeld, with George Bello, and Greuther Fürth, with Julian Green. I think the U.S. could take any MLS team, so that takes out Atlanta with Miles Robinson, Nashville, Walker Zimmerman, New England for now with Matt Turner. Arsenal is probably another team that goes in that initial group along, or maybe they're in the Salzburg tier. I'll put them in that tier two level. But all the MLS teams, LAFC, Dallas, Red Bulls, Seattle, Miami, those all have USMNT players on them. I think the U.S. men's national team would win pretty handily. Maybe that's a bit of a stretch for some of those, but I think they would beat Rangers with James Sands and Fulham with Jedi Robinson, Nottingham Forest with Ethan Horvath, and then maybe the more obscure ones as well with Young Boys and Jordan Pefok, Heracles with Luca De La Torre, and Troyes with EPB. I kind of just went through the most recent World Cup qualifying roster list. I think it really is just that top tier of teams, the six for sure that Graham and I talked about, and maybe a Salzburg and a mid-table La Liga team or a Bundesliga team, Leicester, if we're counting that. That's kind of in that next tier or two underneath that top six.
I kind of have a theory that club teams are actually a lot better than international teams just because of the amount of time that they have together. So I genuinely don't know, Joe, whether I agree or disagree, and we'll never find out. That's the beauty of this question. Like, when you say Rangers, on an individual talent basis, there's absolutely no doubt the US has better players than Rangers. But Rangers are in the semi-finals of the Europa League this season. Like, they are a decent unit. And so as an experiment, I would like to do that, like, FIFA sort of thing where you play an international team against a club team and kind of just see what happens. But I don't think that's ever going to happen, so this is forever going to be a hypothetical.
Graham, let's take it the other way then for a moment. What is the international team that you think would struggle least in this type of situation? Like, Brazil, because they're just Brazil and so good and expect to be dominant regardless of their opponent, do you think they would struggle if they had to play some of the clubs that their players play for?
I'm not sure about Brazil. I'm trying to think what you would want in an international team. You would want an international team that's as close to a club setup as possible. So I'm thinking Italy and the Euros.
Qatar.
They seem to be very cohesive. Qatar. They seem to be very cohesive, and Mancini had them drilled very well, much beyond what you would expect from an international team. So while Italy failed to follow that up by failing to qualify for the 2022 World Cup, if we go back to the Euros, maybe that Italy team would stand a good chance. I just think a lot of international teams, most international teams, to be honest, are just a sum of their parts, whereas the best club teams are more than the sum of their parts. And that's not really a criticism of the international teams or the coaches. It's just down to the lack of time that they get in preparation and on the training pitch with those players and forging those teams. So my theory is that club, you would go lower in terms of individual quality at club level to find a match for an international team than you would expect. But as I say, we're never going to find out whether that theory is true or not.
Gentlemen, I have loved this conversation immensely, but I think on that note, we've talked plenty about the U.S., about potential U.S. players, about potential U.S. opponents at club level. Loved this conversation. Joe Lowry, thank you so much for being part of it.
Thank you, Taylor.
And Graham, thank you as well, my friend.
Thank you, Taylor Rotwell.
Listeners, thank you all so much for joining us, sticking with us. This was only just over an hour. That's on the shorter side for the three of us. Appreciate y'all listening. We will talk to you again many more times this week. But for now, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.